Welcome to the podcast of Grace Covenant Church, where we are transformed by God's grace, connected through relationships, and committed to service.
Well, good morning, Grace. One of the things we get to do on Youth Sunday is celebrate our graduating class. It's an exciting time for these students as they transition from adolescence into adulthood. And it's a time of life that is marked by ceremonies and rituals. Youth Sunday, graduation, being just two of many. Now, the Bible is full of ceremonies and rituals as well. And one of the most important was the blessing given by a father to a son. The patriarchal blessing was of such significance that Esau begged his father to bless him when his brother Jacob stole that blessing for himself. Years later, this same Jacob is an old man. He's on his deathbed, and so he gathers his 12 sons together before him. He knows what this moment means. He's going to bless them. And in Genesis 49, he blesses his 12 sons. Now, there are 12 sons, so we won't look at each blessing, but I would like to show you these four. Jacob looks at his son Issachar, and he says, "Issachar, you are a strong donkey, crouching between sheepfolds. You saw that a land was good and pleasant. You bowed your shoulder to bear, and you became a slave." Issachar is thinking, "Really? A donkey, huh? You did not like that tie I got you for Father's Day. And what's this bit about being a slave? I thought this was a blessing." That's all he gets. Jacob moves right along. He gets to another son named Asher, and he says, "Asher's food shall be rich, and he will make royal delicacies." Short, sweet. Asher's thinking, "I didn't get called a donkey. I'm not going to be a slave, and I get to eat good food. That's all I want. Great." After Asher comes a son named Naphtali. And if naming your son Naphtali wasn't bad enough, there is this blessing. "Naphtali is a doe let loose, and he bears beautiful fawns." Now, I'm sure that in the Hebrew culture and context, that is a very meaningful, beautiful statement. But if the Sound of Music has taught me anything, it's that a doe is a deer, exactly, a female deer at that. So again, thanks, Dad. I'm not sure you have this whole blessing thing down. The next son that Jacob decides to bless is the main character of our time this morning. It's his favorite son, Joseph. And here's what he has to say to Joseph. "Joseph is a fruitful bough by a spring. His branches run over the wall. The archers bitterly attacked him. They shot at him. They harassed him severely. Yet his bow remained unmoved. His arms were made agile by the hands of the Mighty One, the God of Jacob, the Shepherd and Stone of Israel. By the God of your father who will help you. By the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that crouches beneath, blessings of the breast and of the womb, the blessings of your father are mighty beyond the blessings of my parents, up to the bounties of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and on the brow of him who was set apart from his brothers." Now that's a blessing. If you are Issachar or Asher or Naphtali, what is going through your head here? His was better than mine. His was longer. Joseph got a bigger piece of cake than me. And yeah, he did. Why? Because he set himself apart. This blessing is a testament to the life that Joseph has lived. Remember, this is the blessing. Jacob's on his deathbed. Every word is chosen specifically, carefully. This is what he wants to convey to his son. And that's the kind of blessing that I personally would love to receive. Those are the kinds of words that you or I would love to have spoken to us or about us. So my question this morning is, what does it take to become like Joseph? To have that kind of blessing, not from a dying father, but from God himself as you enter into heaven? What would it take to have the credits on your life roll and not have a dry eye in the house? What kinds of decisions would you need to make in order to become the kind of person that God would say, "Well done, you have set yourself apart"? We'll find the answers to those questions in the life of Joseph, in the different moments that set him apart. So we're going to examine the Joseph story this morning, and I'll just warn you and apologize, we are going to have to go very fast. There are parts that we're going to have to skip over. There are some really interesting nuances that we won't get to. So I would highly recommend that you go home and read the story for yourself. At the beginning of the story, Joseph is 17 years old. The Bible tells us that he's the youngest and most beloved son in his family. He's also intelligent, he's handsome, and he is incredibly arrogant. He's a prideful young man. God gives him these dreams that he's going to rule over his brothers, and he says, "Yes, absolutely. It is all about me." And like any good little brother would do, he goes and rubs it in his brothers' faces. These brothers, they already dislike Joseph. They've been jealous of him for some time now. And this is the final straw. So they throw him into a well. They pull him out of this well only so that they can sell him into slavery. These are his brothers, his flesh and his blood. He grew up with these guys. And they betray him. Joseph is a slave in Egypt for 10 years. And during this time, he catches the eye of his master's wife. And she tries to seduce him, but he refuses. He flees. But he's unjustly accused of attempted rape and thrown into prison. At 27 years old, Joseph is sitting in prison. He meets and interprets a dream for one of the Pharaoh's confidants, asking in return that this man will just remember him, help him to get out of prison. But the man forgets. And so Joseph sits there in that cell for 2 more years. One day, the Pharaoh himself has a dream that no one understands. And so Joseph is brought in to try to interpret it. And in Genesis 41, this is what Joseph says. "Yahweh, Jehovah, my God, has given you these dreams." Now that's a bold statement, because this Pharaoh doesn't acknowledge Joseph's God. The advisors in this room could not care less about the God of some Hebrew slave. But Joseph says, "My God gave you these dreams." And here's what they mean. There will be 7 years of harvest throughout the land. Things are going to be good. But then there will be 7 years of a devastating and deadly famine. At this point, Joseph's job is done. He interpreted the dream, case closed. But then he does something brash. He opens his mouth and proceeds to give counsel on what to do, advice on how to deal with this famine, the exact measures needed to save people's lives. Are you kidding me? This is a Hebrew speaking to an Egyptian. This is a slave, an inmate, advising the Pharaoh. Joseph didn't just do something bold. He just did something crazy. Depending on how this Pharaoh reacts, he might have just done something incredibly stupid. This is a Hebrew slave in a foreign land. He has no rights. He has no business telling the Pharaoh what to do. And so what does the Pharaoh do with this Hebrew prisoner? He gives him a job. He hires him. Joseph does such a good job. He is instrumental in saving people's lives that he eventually rises to the rank of Pharaoh's second in command. And 9 years after he interpreted this dream, Joseph is 39 years old. And lo and behold, who comes down to Egypt but his brothers? Remember them from 22 years earlier? The famine has been widespread. It's tough. And these brothers are looking for food. And so they come into Joseph's throne room. They kneel at his feet, but they don't know it's him. But Joseph He knows exactly who they are. He is unrecognizable to them. He's dressed as royalty. It's been 22 years since they saw him. They don't have photographs to remind themselves of what he looked like. But Joseph has all of those memories. That time that he spent in prison, those years that he was a slave, that day that they threw him into a well and sold him to foreigners, all of that is going through his mind right now because the men responsible for it are kneeling at his feet. And the Bible tells us that Joseph has to leave the room and weep. Later on, he returns, he reveals his identity to them, and the brothers are shocked. In all this time, they may have wondered what happened to their little brother, whether or not he was even still alive, but they never expected this. And then their minds turn to fear, because deep down, they know the injustice that they've done. The truth is, they know what they deserve. And when the time is right, when the stage is set, when all seems most appropriate for justice or even vengeance, Joseph delivers forgiveness, mercy, grace. Instead of giving these brothers what they deserved, Joseph lets it go. Make no mistake about it, these brothers did great evil to this man. But he looks at them and says this, Genesis 50:20, what you meant for evil, God meant for good. This is one of the most emotional scenes of forgiveness in the Bible. What you meant for evil, God meant for good. That's an audacious statement, isn't it? Joseph experienced terrible things at the hands of his brothers. He had a dream his life would be so very different from what he had to go through. What you meant for evil, God meant for good. I summarized this story for you just now, but if you go home and you read it for yourself, you will see, you'll feel that these brothers deserve something. They deserve payback. But there is no scene of divine retribution. The story ends with forgiveness. This would be like if the movie Gladiator ended with Maximus and the Emperor hugging in the middle of the Colosseum, shaking hands, patting each other on the back, and walking away. And admit it, you would be frustrated if that happened. That would no longer be your favorite movie. You wouldn't buy that DVD and you wouldn't recommend it to your friends because that ending would be ludicrous. But that's exactly what's happening here. These brothers did evil to this man. And part of me, I'll be honest, it's the unsanctified part of me. Part of me wants Joseph to go after these guys in a moment of revenge that makes Michael Corleone look like Mr. Rogers. I want that for this man. But that's not what happens. He forgives them and he lets go. Joseph doesn't curse them. He doesn't even scold them. He says, what you meant for evil, God meant for good. How is he able to forgive in this way? How can he do that? Joseph actually tells us one verse before in Genesis 50:19, where he says, do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Am I in the place of God? You see, Joseph, 22 years after arguably the worst day of his life, understands that he can forgive his brothers for what they've done because he trusts in a sovereign God. Joseph is able to let go because he understands that he is not God. And this is where true forgiveness comes from. Trust in a sovereign God. Joseph understands that God is sovereign, which means that God has a plan. God has a story in mind, and he is powerful enough to fulfill that plan, to tell whatever story he wants to. And so Joseph just lets go and believes that he is part of that story, that no matter what, God is just and God can redeem. How did he come about this perspective? Where did he learn that? Maybe it happened for him sitting at the bottom of that well. It seems a little early to me. It could have been those 10 years he spent as a slave, because he would have had plenty of time to think about it. I think this idea finally clicked for him, though, in prison. Those 3 years sitting in shackles, feeling forgotten, forsaken, abandoned, Joseph had to make a choice. He could continue to hold on to the memories of the injustice of his life, haunted by his past, growing bitter and cold. Or he could let go, and he could believe and trust that God was not done with him. And look what happens. He's released from prison. He goes and interprets a dream, and he gives all of the credit to God. He could have made that moment all about himself. He could have said, yes, it's all about me. But he said, no, it's all God. Because Joseph realizes that all of the events of his life, some that he could control, most that he could not, put him in the exact place that God wanted him, at the exact moment that God wanted him there. Because this is what God does. This is how he works. Just look through the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. There is a story that God loves to tell time and time again, and it is a story of redemption. God will take these moments of tremendous pain, tremendous hurt, tremendous evil, and he will turn them around. He'll make them good. The life of Joseph is fascinating, and it takes up more space in the book of Genesis than any other story. The creation of the earth, creation of Adam and Eve, those are summarized in a couple of chapters. Joseph's life is given 13. And it's no wonder. It's a remarkable story. And it teaches us, it gives us great insight into how God interacts with humanity. It shows us what real forgiveness looks like. Because let me be clear, for you and for me, just as it was for Joseph, forgiveness is a choice. Forgiveness is a choice. Because our default setting is unforgiveness. Our natural tendency, it's like gravity, it's like water rolling down a hill, is to not forgive people. Because unforgiveness gives us power and entitlement. By not forgiving, we're able to hold on to this thing that someone did to us, and in our minds, we can hold it over this guilty person's head and say, I didn't deserve that, and so they don't deserve my forgiveness. It's power. It's a sense of self-righteous entitlement, and it leads to a deep-seated bitterness. By not forgiving, we also create an identity for ourselves. But it's a false identity, built on a supposed superiority because of a justice that we feel we deserve. It's an identity predisposed to a victim mentality. By not forgiving, we adopt a woe is me attitude and outlook towards people and towards life. And finally, by holding tightly to unforgiveness, we try to put ourselves into the position of God himself. We declare ourselves judge, jury, and executioner of those around us, saying, I will dole out the consequences for the sin done to me. But that's not our job. It never has been. Look at Genesis 50:19 again. Am I in the place of God? The answer is a resounding no. And so, on the other hand, the cure for unforgiveness is this choice to forgive. Because forgiveness is a choice. It is not a feeling. It is an act of the will. Author and seminary professor Neil Anderson says this: do not wait to forgive someone until you feel like forgiving them, because you will never get there. Your feelings will take time to heal after the choice to forgive has been made. This is the path to forgiveness. Acknowledge that it hurt, that it was significant, maybe even that it was evil. and then choose to forgive. This is not saying, oh, no worries, it wasn't that big a deal, sweeping it under the rug and letting resentment build. No, not at all. This is not saying, maybe I deserved part of it. No. True biblical forgiveness says it was wrong, it mattered, but I release you. I forgive you and I let it go. I've become increasingly intrigued by the life story of Nelson Mandela. There was the movie Invictus a few years ago, and I recently finished his autobiography. And one thing really stands out about this man, and that is his capacity to forgive. You see, Nelson Mandela trained as a lawyer and worked for the African National Congress, fighting to end apartheid in South Africa during the 60s and the 70s. And for his work in civil rights, he was thrown in prison for 27 years. And when I say prison, what I really mean is more of a hard labor camp. Breaking big rocks, hauling off the smaller pieces, breaking more big rocks, day after day after day. The amazing thing is not that he survived these 27 years in prison or that he continued to work for civil rights. The amazing thing is that when he was finally released, Mandela showed no bitterness or hatred, just forgiveness and love. Former President Clinton had the opportunity to interview Nelson Mandela, and he asked him, I watched you walk down that dirt road, out of prison towards freedom. When you were walking down there and you realized how long you had been in their prison, didn't you hate them then? Didn't you feel some kind of hatred? And Mandela's response was this, yes, I did. A little bit. But as I felt the anger and the bitterness rising up within me, I thought to myself, they have already had you for 27 years. If you keep hating them, if you do not forgive, they will have you all over again. And I said, I want to be free. I want to be free. And so I let it go. That's what I'm asking you to do today, to be free, to forgive whoever it is in your life that you need to forgive and to let go of that bitterness or anger that may have occupied that corner of your heart for weeks or months or even years, to choose forgiveness. And maybe what that means for you is this week, you spend some time alone with God. And you ask him to bring to mind the people that it's time to forgive. And as God brings to mind the names and the faces and the events of your life, you write those things down. And when you're done, you take that piece of paper and you fold it up and you place it squarely between your hands and you pray, God, I am not you. I am not in the place of God. And so I lay down my desire for justice at your feet. I trust that you are sovereign, that you are just, that you are good and you can redeem. Allow me to forgive as I have been forgiven. And then you take that piece of paper and you let it go. Literally, tear it into strips of paper and make it confetti. Throw it into your trash can or your fireplace. Go to the top of Mount Bonnell and just let it go. Whatever it takes to physically remind yourself that you are free, that you are forgiving, that you're letting go out of your hands and into God's. It seems rather obvious, but forgiveness is a much better path. The grace of our own salvation is the ultimate argument for this truth. To forgive others, as Ephesians 4:32 says, as God has forgiven us through Christ. Because forgiveness is the only way to negotiate through the weakness and failure that will daily mark your relationships. It's the only way to deal with the hurts and the disappointments that are a natural part of life. Forgiveness is the only way to not be haunted, kidnapped by your past. And so I'm asking you to consider that today. Could you forgive and let go? And more than that, really the reason that we can do that is I'm asking you to consider and trust in the sovereignty of God. Could you trust God for the life that you have? Could you look at your life, the decisions that you've made and the ones that you had no control over, and believe that God had a purpose for it? Could you forgive and let go, trusting God for the reality that you were raised by alcoholic parents or for absent parents? Could you trust God for your life as a result of divorce? For your current situation as a result of an injustice done to you at work or in a friendship? Could you trust God in the midst of pain that He is not done with you? I know what some of you may be thinking. Kevin, you have no idea what I've been through. You don't know me. You don't know what other people have done to me. How can I just forgive? How can I trust God? And you're right. I don't know you. I don't know what you've been through. But what I do know is that we worship a mighty and sovereign God, a God that loves to tell stories of redemption, who is able to work evil for good, a God that is present and active even when it feels like He is far away. Could you trust that God, not only so that you could forgive, but could you trust Him for the very life that you've been given? Because what if the experiences of your life were given to you to help you be conformed to the image of Jesus Christ? What if the things meant for evil against you by man were ultimately meant for good by God? Look back on your life, take an honest look, and you may see that if it wasn't for that bad thing, I could have never gotten to this good place. If it wasn't for that, I couldn't be where I am today in my faith. It may be time to thank God for that, to let your perspective be changed and to see that God was shaping you, forming you into the image of His Son. Because this is how He moved through the life of Joseph. How was God able to take this arrogant, young know-it-all and transform him into the only person capable of interpreting a dream, advising a Pharaoh, and saving countless lives? God did it by letting him be thrown into a well. God allowed Joseph to be sold into slavery. God placed him in Potiphar's house, knowing full well and letting him be accused of a horrendous crime and thrown into prison. And then God allowed him to sit there for 3 years. And so when Joseph stands before this Pharaoh courageously as an interpreter and advisor, where did he find that courage? How was his character forged? By the life that God had given him. He became the man that he was that day because of the experiences of his life. Joseph entrusted it all. He gave everything that he had to God. He believed that he was part of God's story. And so even at the darkest hour, even at his lowest moment, he said, God, I know you're going to do something with me. And as his father is lying on his deathbed, he pulls Joseph close and he blesses him extravagantly. Because Joseph set himself apart. His was a life well lived. So to my original question, what does it take to become like Joseph? To receive this kind of blessing from God? To hear, well done, you have stood apart. The life of Joseph teaches us these two things. that we need to forgive and let go, and that we need to trust in God's sovereignty, that He is God and we are not. So could we do that this morning? And would you pray with me for those two things? That we could forgive others knowing that we have been forgiven. That we could let go of the unforgiveness and the bitterness. And we could trust in God's sovereignty for the lives that we have. That there is a plan and a purpose. And that God is telling a story through you, and that it can be a story of redemption. Would you pray with me this morning? Father, we thank you for who you are. We thank you for all that you've done and all that you continue to do. And God, most of all, we thank you for your Son, through whom we have been forgiven. Father, allow us to forgive. Allow us to be people of forgiveness and grace who have been forgiven much, and so we too forgive. God, help us to trust in your sovereignty, to know that there is a plan, that there is a purpose, that even when things hurt, God, you are doing something in our lives. God, we thank you again for all that you've done. We praise you and we worship you, and it is in your name that we pray. Amen.
For more information about Grace, visit our website at grace360.org.